Going to go ahead and gavel in here. The meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy will come to order. It is now 3:06 p.m., Tuesday, February 27, 2011, here in the Ramona Barnes Committee Room of the Alaska Capitol, Room 124. Members present, Representative Pete Peterson, Representative Sadler, Representative Pruitt, Representative Tuck, and myself, Representative Foster. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. As a reminder, please turn off your cell phones or silence them or turn them to vibrate. Today we'll continue hearings on House Bill 103, the Governor Parnell's measure to empower the Alaska Energy Authority to build a large hydroelectric dam in the lower Wetana area on the Susitna River. At last Thursday's hearing, questions were raised about a March 16, 2009 study that estimated costs to be $8.3 billion, and that's higher than the recent estimate of $4.5 billion. Members should have a copy of that study, which was prepared for the Alaska Energy Authority by HDR Alaska and Northern Economics. Testifying from Juneau are Sarah Fisher Goad, Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority, and Senior Assistant Attorney Brian Bjorkquist. And online from Anchorage, to answer questions, we have Brian Carey and Christopher Rutz of Alaska Energy Authority. For the record, please let the record reflect that Representative Olson is with us. We won't be taking public testimony today, but we will be doing this on Thursday. So if we could have Sarah and Brian come to the table, and please state your name and title for the record, and please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Sarah Fisher Goad. I'm the Executive Director for the Alaska Energy Authority.
And for the record, I am Brian Bjorkquist, Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Department of Law.
Mr. Chairman, the report that you referenced, it was brought up the last time we were before you, and Brian Carey, our project manager, is online in Anchorage and is prepared to address the difference of the cost estimates from that report versus what we provided more recently.
Thank you. Brian, can you hear us okay? Okay.
Did you hear that last part?
Oh, go ahead. No, we didn't hear anything.
Okay. This is, for the record, this is Brian Carey with Alaska Energy Authority.
Thank you. Please proceed, Brian.
Yes, I am here to answer some of those questions on the cost, the probable construction cost. Okay. The March report that has been identified, one of the parts that's really important to remember is it was an interim memorandum. It was not the final type report. The 8.3 or 8.4 you're hearing about is for the full-size Wetana, 885 feet. What we've been presenting much more this year has been the Wetana project at the 700 feet. So that's a substantial difference right there. The March report showed Low Wetana as being 6.9. After we had those numbers, we realized there was some errors in some of the cost numbers. Back in the details, one is the March numbers came from more bringing the old Susitna project forward to the current days, and with a bunch of the unit cost, bringing those forward to the current unit cost. However, because much more of the earth-moving equipment is much more larger equipment now and everything's more efficient, the camp cost would be, one, substantially different. Before, it was assumed that the camp would need to be able to have housing for up to 3,000 people plus families, and after the project was done, there would remain at the camp actually not only fire station, hospital, but also, I believe, a school. And so it's modeled as being, at the end of the project, a town where that many people would live. the current estimate with using it much more as a camp without families and the fact that you're using much larger equipment than you did before, you're looking at perhaps 800 or 900 people as a peak labor force at the camp. So the camp cost was one substantially reduced in the order of, I believe, $400 or $500 million. So it was a large number. Another difference would have been is on the access, there was a number of close to $600 million for access. It was realized that the numbers in there for a large suspension bridge at Devil Canyon was still in the Watonna number. The access that was thought to be the best access for the 1980s was to come in from the north off the Denali Highway. If you were to take a look at the cost of bringing a road in from Denali Highway, that's what we did. We, for the November report, whereas the March report still had numbers in there for having the road from Denali Highway, but it also had in the road numbers and bridge from the Devil Canyon side. Another substantial change was in terms of the transmission. The transmission lines that were around in 1982, certainly around Anchorage and the Matanuska Valley, was much less than it is now. And so at that time, the cost estimate had transmission line, well, had transmission lines and submarine cable going all the way into Anchorage and making changes to the substations at Anchorage and Esther up towards Fairbanks, Willow, and multiple other ones. We took the transmission lines from Gold Creek out, the Gold Creek along with existing intertie is. We know that's still a substantial number, but there's still a lot more work to be done about what upgrades have to occur down in the Willow area and the Anchorage area, being that there's been substantial changes to the transmission substations down here since the 1982. Some other large, and those large changes make large changes all the way through because you've added, there's the 20% contingency cost. So by the time we make any changes there, then you have the 20% contingency cost moving in. That creates a greater amount. And I also forgot to mention, under the line for the engineering, environmental, construction management, that normally goes along as being a just a percentage. And so we had down as a 11% to cover that. With the larger number of $6.5 billion, it came up to somewhere around $600 million. Well, we recognize that one is there's already been a substantial amount of engineering and environmental work that's been performed on this project, and so it'd be very valid to reduce that number to reflect some of the studies that have already occurred, both engineering and environmental-wise. And it's also, as you get a larger and larger project, the basic cross-section of the dam is not changing that much. And so to do a the amount of money it is to spend on a dam cross-section that's at 600 feet tall versus 300 feet tall, just because it may cost you twice as much to make the larger dam, as a percentage of cost, the design is a lower percentage. And so for that reason, we have a lower number in there for the environmental engineering construction management. It's still a large number to be able to cover everything, but it's lower compared to what it was back in March. So because of those different changes in, say, like the camps, access, transmission, environmental engineering numbers, and by the time you start multiplying them out with the contingency numbers in there, it makes the large drop in cost.
Are there any questions of the committee? Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Hey, Brian, question. You, when you spoke of camp housing, you said that that reduced the cost by $400 to $500 million. Could you kind of run down those four or five categories you listed and kind of give us the idea of how much the cost would come down those categories? For example, earth moving, you did camp housing, about for access and transmission lines. If you can kind of give us a systematic presentation of how much less they are in those categories, that'd be helpful. Just helpful to understand the difference.
Okay. The construction camp, the reduction in it, as being $429 million?
If you could say in the old versus the new.
Okay. The old construction camp was $612 million. And the new for the I'll go off and give the numbers for what would be the low Wetona non-expandable, but I could give it low Wetona expandable or non-expandable, whichever you want me to do. But just to say the non-expandable amount, that would be
Sarah Fisher-Goad has a comment.
Mr. Chairman, I think what would maybe be helpful for, instead of running through numbers, I don't know about the committee, but I know hearing the numbers is very difficult to visualize them, and I'm wondering if it would be helpful, since you are going to be hearing this bill a couple more times, could we establish a spreadsheet that shows you the differences from now to then? And I think that would get Brian off the hook on trying to come up with those numbers directly. So, Mr. Chairman, we'll be happy to prepare that as quickly as possible this week.
Great.
Thank you. Thank you. Representative Tuck?
Along with that, Mr. Chair, if you don't mind, regarding the transmission line going from Gold Creek out, if we can have those numbers removed from the old 1982 or 1985, I don't know which one you're going off of, so we can compare apples to apples on that also.
Sure.
Okay. And, Mr. Chairman, and Brian, I just want to clarify on what you'll be preparing, and we'll work on that tomorrow.
Yes, I'll be working on a spreadsheet that shows the change in numbers that have occurred from March to November, and as part of the spreadsheet, also it have the Gold Creek to other points type of cost.
Representative Peterson, and then Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, as we're talking about transmission lines, and this is a project that's going to be completed in quite a few years in advance from now, do you think we might be upgrading to a smart grid at any time in the future? And would it be possible to include maybe pricing for that in the estimates?
Mr. Chairman, the cost estimate for doing work in regards to a smart grid, I believe that there's been some references during the integrated resource plan, and I can see if we have those numbers around. I suspect that if those numbers have not been generated already, that it would likely take several months to generate those numbers, as we would first have to have the contractor figure out exactly what is needed, and then along with the what is needed, come up with some type of cost on it.
Okay, I just thought you might already have them, so I was just seeing if they were available.
Representative Pruitt.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. While we're putting this together, I think it might be prudent at the same time to discuss the cost, the kilowatt per hour cost to the consumer, because there's numbers in here that utilize the information that the report has. If while he's going ahead and comparing, if he could give us what he would expect the cost to be at the revised rate, that would be really helpful. And then just in that same vein, I know the Bradley Lake project had 50% state and if you can also, and this is all speculative, I understand that, but just an estimate of what we expect if the state kicked in at different levels, what it might be to the consumer. So we have an idea of what to expect, and then compare that to the cost of what it is now and to other sources of generation. Thank you so much.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And just going back on the engineering and environmental, a lot of it's been done already. And just judging, I mean, just looking at this report that we have here, there is on page 4 under the background section, it says here that the project had expended $145 million during the fiscal year 79 through fiscal year 86. And then in 2009, it doesn't say what the amount of the capital budget was, but it authorized AEA to reevaluate. When you said that there's been engineering and environmental already done, was what you're referring to, these two studies?
Representative Tuck, for the chair, most of the work that was done, of course, has been back in the early 80s. The work that has been done more recently, it's generally hard for us to get a substantial amount of time and resources spent by certainly the federal agencies at this time when we are doing when we do not have a preliminary permit. And so there has not been substantial environmental work done by AEA since with the money out 2009. That was more engineering-type studies and conceptual ones to try and get a better idea of what costs would be now under both embankment or possible roller compacted concrete type dam. So there's still the cost estimate for whichever method is maybe chosen has certainly unknowns at this time, and the environmental definitely has why there's been a substantial amount of work done back in the 80s, more environmental work will be required to be done at this time to reflect changes in regulation, changes in what is known about the resources.
Okay, Mr. Chair, if we can, with that cost analysis, also demonstrate where we're, because he said, I believe it was $600 million at 11% of the project that were saved. So if we can show how the engineering environmental was saved also, so we can keep it the apples to apples, oranges to oranges between old evaluation and new evaluation. And then one other question, Mr. Chair. And then also, I believe under the FERC licensing, it talked about an 8-year time period to do the FERC licensing. We just heard last committee hearing that we might have a 5-year, and that's on page 2. And it says here in the second sentence of the fourth paragraph, based on the modern integrated licensing process, obtaining the FERC license for Susitna is expected to require an ambitious, sustained effort, with issuance of the license expected in approximately 8 years. Can you also explain why, or how we're able to cut that from 8 years down to 5 years?
Representative Tuck, for the chair, how long it will take us to receive a license is certainly a little bit subjective through the different opinions. A bunch of the work that was done on terms of the 5 years is by a person at one of the consulting firms that used to be employed at FERC working with licensing. And so why we know that 5 years is on a more aggressive schedule, it can certainly be done in that time period. And that's what the person from the former FERC employee has indicated. There's no guarantees at 5 years, but it's definitely a doable thing. Some of the licensing processes have specific times that the applicant and the resource agencies must complete different studies on.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then, so, because this does say 8 years with an ambitious ambitious sustained effort, so we just assume that we're just going to go super ambitious on the five-year FERC filing, or is there a way that we can demonstrate with the timeline the difference between the two based on, sounds like there's some stuff that's being taken out, transmission lines and everything else, maybe that changes. I have no idea, but if we can demonstrate how we can cut it down to 5 years, I'd appreciate that.
Representative Tuck, we will try and address that better. It's certainly, as I mentioned, kind of subjective in terms of what people believe, how quick it can occur, and certainly there's slowdowns that are hard to forecast when they may occur because of it's hard to point to a specific possibility as a slowing down at this date.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Other questions? I've got a question here. If you go to the report, page 3, table 1 here, looking at costs per kilowatt hour, and it says here for the first 50 years on the Lowatana project, we're looking at 20 cents per kilowatt hour. How does that compare with other hydroelectric projects, both inside and outside of Alaska, at rate?
Mr. Chair, that's the 20 cents is definitely a higher cost than any of the other current hydroelectric projects in the state, and it's going to be a higher cost than what hydroelectric projects out of state are. Mm-hmm. When this 20 cents, though, there again, you must be careful that this is on the interim project management, well, interim numbers at the higher amount of 6.9, and it was also done as being 100% private equity financing, which is not likely to occur. So 20 cents, most places have the opportunity to generate energy at a much lower cost, and so generally what you get down Pacific Northwest is they're probably generating at certainly less than 5 cents, and because a lot of the dams that they have been around for more than 50 years, they're probably down at a penny per kilowatt. In the case of once the bonds are paid back on a project like this, we'd be generating down at a penny per kilowatt.
Thank you. Other questions? Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So if the state were to put up, say, somewhere around 50% of the cost of constructing this project and set it up to get paid back after the initial 50-year payback, would the cost of power could possibly be somewhere around 10 cents?
Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead.
One is, once the bonds are paid back, determining if the state has capital contributions to the project, such as in the case of Bradley Hydro. In the case of Bradley Hydro, after 35 years, the bonds will be paid back, and then at that time, the state will be getting paid back for its contribution. Depending on the length of the time that the state is to be receiving funds back on it, when the state no longer wishes to be receive funds back for the project, then the cost of generation at that time will be likely less than a penny per kilowatt.
Okay. Do you have a question, Representative Pruitt?
I want to switch gears just slightly, though. Do we have an understanding of I understand somewhere out there, and I don't know where it might be, of who owns the land that we're going to be impacting, and how do we know how who, like, I'm going to guess there's Native Corporation, there's possibly state land, even potentially federal land, even villages. Do we know who all we're going to be affecting? Is there potentially a map? I mean, I'm just curious is all on that.
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the major landholders are the federal government, I believe, Tyonek, Siri, and I believe there is some state land. I think there will, through this process, we're going to have to identify the landowners. And beyond those major landowners, Brian, do you have anything to add at this point?
Mr. Chair, no.
Do we have any idea if the major players that like Tyonek and some of those that we've identified are, do we understand where they are on this? Are they behind it? Are they just waiting to see what happened? Of course, we've been talking about this for 30 years, so they could be at this time just wondering if we're even going to act, I guess. Do we know where they might be potentially in their support?
Mr. Chair, Tyonek Native Corporation has indicated that they would be able to give a letter of support, and we are still in discussions with Siri.
Okay.
Interestingly, if I could just point out, I think in prior testimony it was mentioned that Tyonek was near the Chakachamna project. Is that correct? But yeah. they coincidentally also have land up there in the Susitna area there, and so. Does that answer your question okay?
Yeah, that's fine. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Another question I have here, I guess series of questions, I should say. If maybe we could kind of just do a general brief explanation of the sections on how this would build the Watana Dam. But first question, I guess, going back to the procurement, you look at Section 1 here, and how will the changes in Section 1 regarding procurement help to advance a dam?
Through the chair, or excuse me, Mr. Chairman, the procurement section of the legislation obviously this legislation focuses a lot on this large project that we're looking at. The procurement section is a little bit broader than that, and it's really one part of the bill that's really beyond the large project. It's really talking about AEA's processes internally as a state corporation. And the purpose of this section is to give AEA the authority, as other public corporations have, such as the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, to establish one set of procurement rules for all of the procurement processes that AEA is involved in. We have 3630, which is the procurement code. We have procurements that we do based upon 3630. We also have a significant amount of procurement that we do based upon us working for communities to procure services and through grant processes. So what we want to do, and this is kind of more of an internal efficiency process, to allow AEA to live under one set of rules. It's an APA process, which is the Administrative Procedures Act. We would go through a public process to adopt regulations to establish those procurement rules. With respect to how this would impact a large project, typically, I'm going to turn this over to Chris Rutz, our procurement officer, to provide some further information. But one issue with a larger project, oftentimes there are specific procurement plans that are established for large projects, and especially something like this, we would expect a specific procurement plan, whether it's through 3630 or not. There would be a kind of a separate path that we would be going on for a project such as this. And with that, if you want some additional information on how this would work, I think Chris is probably best to answer that, because this has been a question that has come up.
And Chris, are you there?
Yes, I am. My name is Chris Rutz, and I'm the procurement officer for the Alaska Energy Authority.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Yeah, we have, anticipating this question, I had the opportunity to talk with Montgomery Watson, who is assisting us in the engineering aspects of this project, and ask them some questions regarding how are they doing procurement around the world these days when it comes to big projects. Over the 30 years, a lot of different types of procurement models have evolved from the standard design, bid, build model. Some of the things that they shared us, in fact, probably one of the most important things they shared was that you really need a qualifications-based selection process, not just a standard low bid. In fact, they commented that if you're going to put out a standard low bid on a dam of this size, the only people who would probably bid on it and assume all the risk would be the Chinese. Clearly that's not an acceptable model for folks within the state of Alaska. But there were some different kinds of models that they used. They talked about different levels of partnering. They also talked about doing owner-supplied materials on certain aspects of it, in which case the owner would make an arrangement long in advance of any kind of construction contract being in place for some of the key components like the turbines or other things. They also indicated that owner-supplied material could also work for items like transformers or other items. This would be a very, very complex procurement and would involve a lot of people in the process, analyzing the risk, determining what might be the best methods to go forward to assure that you get best value, and making sure that you're selecting competent contractors to do the job. I would also expect that the legislature is probably going to be very interested in jobs for Alaskans and what types of things might we be able to do in contract, possibly that we couldn't necessarily do in statute with respect to encouraging the use of local labor. So I couldn't begin to think of how this would actually shake out, but I would expect that regardless of whether we're under 3630 or we would have our own rules, there are going to be a lot of discussions with the construction experts in this state as well as the industry to try to determine what the best way to procure this would be going forward.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that we're using the Bradley Lake as the model for a project like this. Can you tell me what procurement code was with Bradley Lake? Wasn't that done through the Department of Transportation?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, I can't speak to who actually did it at the time, but that was done pre-procurement code. I believe the procurement code was established in 1988, and I had the pleasure of actually working on it at the time as a procurement officer for the Alaska Department of Natural Resources. And I believe Bradley was procured before then, and I can't tell you whether it was the Alaska Power Authority did it under following their own procurement guidelines or whether it was done through DOT. I can check into that and get back to you.
Yeah, if you will. Thank you.
Thank you. We could just take a quick brief at ease if people need to use the bathroom just for a moment. Energy Committee, February 22, gaveling back in at 3:42. I think we're going to be losing some folks and some will be coming back, but I think we'll still have a quorum here. So were there any questions before I jumped into sectional descriptions and explanations here? Anything? No? Okay. If you wouldn't mind, if you could just, Sarah, if you could start going through sectional analysis here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is there, Mr. Chairman, we have gone through a sectional analysis before. Are there specific areas that you want to discuss or have concerns with? Or
sorry. Oh, go ahead. Oh. Brief it, ease. Sounds like I was gone that day, but I think we'll keep this open, though, in case there are questions in regards to specific questions that committee members may have regarding parts of the sections here. Are there any questions?
Well,
Representative Peterson?
I was actually wanting to go back to the project evaluation report, and we've just talked about the impact on fish a little bit in the previous meeting, and since then I've talked to a couple of other legislators and some constituents, and they were informing me that they thought there were a lot more fish than just a few hundred salmon that were mentioned in the last report, and I was here. It mentions approximately 20,000 Arctic grayling. There's also some trout, as I understand, and so I'm wondering if there's going to be more pushback from fish environmental type groups than what we might have thought was the case.
Through the chair, Representative Peterson, we've actually received a letter. Both the Commissioner of Fish and Game and I have received a letter from a couple legislators asking for some further information about some fish impacts. And again, as we've discussed before, the preliminary permit application is really kind of the starting point and the trigger to start analyzing the projects. This is our engagement with the federal agency and the licensing agency that, along with the resource agencies, will develop what needs to be studied, what needs to be updated from the 80s, and what additional information we would need with respect to, habitat issues and fishing game issues. So I think that's something that I know is a concern out there, and we will be, of course, working to address that through this process.
Okay. All right. Thanks.
Thank you. Go ahead, Brian.
Just to add something to that, during the FERC licensing process, one of the obligations that FERC does have is to work with the resource agencies and look at fish and wildlife protections that are necessary and incorporate those into the license conditions. And so that will be an ongoing task that FERC will have through the licensing processes to look at and to accommodate those types of issues, mitigate enhancement of impacts on fish and wildlife that happens through the development.
Okay.
Did you, Representative Pruitt?
A couple questions. I want to start off with there's been a lot of talk, obviously, about the plan, the potential, what the idea is, Susanna. Is there an actual business plan in place for building the Susitna project?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, I guess with respect to when there's several different stages that this project is going to go through, starting with the FERC licensing process, and then there will also be a financing plan. I guess if that's what you mean with respect to a business plan, is that there would have to be the analysis of, there's a lot of places where there's going to be an analysis of this project. Again, through the FERC process and the licensing, a financing plan with respect to the utilities and the power sales agreement, and then also that this project is obviously a large project, and there is the discussion with respect to the state having a role in the project by capital contributions, issuing debt, that I guess when you talk about a business plan, I think it's all of it is that at some point or another, there's going to be the analysis on, this project moving forward would be a certain cost of power, and that there would be the commitment that the power would be purchased, and then there's the decision on whether we go forward. So there's a variety of places that there would be decision points. I think that's if I can... Is that what you're discussing.
Yeah, that's kind of the. I guess I'll clarify. I want to make sure that we're specifically talking that there is a. We know what the end result is, and obviously we want to make sure that we've got the proper plan in place to get there. And that's kind of what I get. You're hitting. Yeah. I mean, you're hitting on it. I'm just making sure that we've got something, whether it's in writing, and maybe it's not in writing, or something that we can say, hey, this is the plan. This is the course of action that we're taking. And again, it goes kind of back to the discussion of why we're talking about the total cost factor. Mm-hmm. We want to make sure that we can say, hey, this is it. This is what we can expect until we get to the end of the project. So, does that make sense?
And through the chair, the capital project request we've provided a kind of a estimated schedule, and how far the $65 million would get us through this process, and all the steps that we'd be taking during that process. So, again, there's through this kind of the culmination of the FERC licensing process and then the development of the PSAs, which kind of like everything will come together at some point, preferably within about, 5 years. But, of course, there will be decision points through the time. I guess I'm not saying this very well, but I think I understand what you're, where you're at. And the bottom line is similar to, I guess, what happened in the 80s. There was a time that it was decided not to move forward with the project, and for a variety of reasons. And we're in this process now. I think starting back in 2008, when we were asked to kind of dust off the project and see what made sense to move forward, we're starting that process again. And I can't guarantee at this point that a project will be built, but in order to things are set in place that with the goal of having 50% of our electricity generated with renewable resources, this is the project that makes the most sense to move forward with. Through the FERC licensing process, there's a lot of unknowns, but we have to actually get into that process before we know whether there's issues that would stop a project.
Okay.
And if I, through the chair, Brian Bjorka, Senior Assistant Attorney General, the real point where you have a business plan is going to be at that point where FERC is prepared to license or not, the utilities are prepared to purchase power or not, RCA is prepared to approve the power sales agreement or not, and the legislature is going to be willing to appropriate or not. At that point, basically, all the components of the transaction have to be put together. Power sales agreements have to be in place. If not, operating and maintenance plans for contracts for the operation, the plans have to be in place. Plans for transmission of power have to be in place. These are all components that FERC looks at to make sure that they have that there's a viable project, that you have people competent and prepared to go forward with the project and make it work, that there's viability to it. And those are the same issues that RCA is going to look at. Those are the same issues the utilities are going to look at. And those are the same issues the legislature will look at as to whether to appropriate the large amounts of money people are anticipating for this project. At this point, all we can provide is preliminary information as to what it looks like the cost might be, subject to everything that's going to be discovered through the FERC licensing process. We could not tell you what the conditions of the license are going to be and how that's going to impact the cost of power until FERC goes through its process and determines what those licensing conditions are going to be, just as an example. But the point where you're going to have that real business plan is when all of those things probably happen in an iterative fashion, almost together, because what happens in one is going to impact the decisions by other players at pretty much the same time.
Okay.
Yeah. Thank you, Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Hey, a brief question, just a term of art, renewable. There's some question I remember reading someplace as to whether hydroelectric energy is considered renewable under a federal definition schema. I think it is, but is there a term of art, renewable, and does hydroelectric energy from Mississippi Dam qualify as renewable? It's a bit of a technical question, but...
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, it's my understanding that for certain programs, federal programs in particular, hydroelectric is not considered a renewable. And my understanding is that has a lot to do with the perception of hydroelectric in the lower 48, which is different than the perception of hydroelectric in Alaska for a lot of reasons. The energy market in the lower 48 is completely different than up here. If you don't get power from a hydroelectric project, you can just buy it off the grid from some other supplier, and it's really not a problem. In Alaska, in particular with some of the smaller communities, the option is hydroelectric or diesel. And that's just a completely different, you know, frame of reference. So I would suggest Lower 48, their interpretations of what's renewable and, you know, appropriate going forward, and what up here, particularly in smaller communities, is there's a different frame of reference.
So in the Lower 48, hydro is not considered renewable?
Through the chair, Representative Satterley, it's my understanding that at least for some federal programs and financing programs, it's not included. But I couldn't tell you the specifics.
Okay.
Thank you. Just on that comment, I believe it's the Alaska Power Association maybe that's has been pushing that to have the federal government ensure or move to make that a renewable. The definition, make hydro renewable. Maybe other people could. We'll get to that another point. But one thing I wanted to follow up on is Representative Peterson regarding fish. Do you have a copy of the letter that came from Representative Lescarra as well as Senator Bill Wilikowski, just wanting to make sure that we're following up on that?
Mr. Chairman, yes, that was a letter I was referring to.
Okay.
And so I do have a copy of that letter.
Do all the committee members, have you seen that?
No, I haven't.
Okay. Maybe if we could just get a copy. And I'd also like to recognize that Representative Bob Lynn has also joined us here.
Excuse me for being late. I had a bill up in House Finance.
Absolutely.
Which we got passed.
Congratulations.
Question I had, Sarah, we spoke about this some regarding if HB 103 is passed, what that does is that empowers the AEA, and then eventually you'd have appropriations made into the Alaska Rail Belt Energy Fund. Legislature would control what goes into that, but what comes out, different story. Can you maybe just elaborate on that regarding some of the concerns that people have had about the scope, you know, the breadth and limits of the powers of AEA, and you had mentioned, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. The House Bill 103 provides the general authority, like a pre-1993 authority for AEA to construct and own new projects. We, of course, have the specific project in mind that we're pursuing, and also is accompanied by a capital appropriation, of course, in a separate bill to provide funds to AEA to pursue this project. Taking the appropriation section, what we've proposed in the legislation would, if money was used to capitalize the Alaska Railroad Energy Fund, which of course would require a legislative appropriation, the language as it exists now in the statute would allow AEA to issue grants and to do certain things without further legislative appropriation. Some of the concern has been, and this has been a long-standing concern or issue with respect to what authority you want the agencies to have, and this is in general with respect to expending funds out of particular funds. The legislature has chosen a variety of ways for a variety of funds to and a variety of level of authority that AEA has. For example, the Emerging Energy Technology Fund has been capitalized with $2.4 million. We're in a process of soliciting applications and expect to have a ranking process and a plan to issue grants. We do not need further legislative appropriations or authority to issue those grants. The fund allows us to go through this process and then to issue grants. the Renewable Energy Fund is actually a Renewable Energy Fund grant recommendation program, which is kind of on the other end of the spectrum, which requires us to go through a solicitation process for grants, submit the detailed information, and list to the legislature, who then chooses to provide funding to us for a specific list of projects. So it's a bit of a different aspect. This fund, as proposed, is more in line with the Emerging Energy Technology Fund if the fund is capitalized with funds that AEA had a certain amount of latitude to spend the funds without further legislative appropriation. Similar to the Southeast Energy Fund that was repealed and reenacted last year, would allow us to issue grants without further legislative appropriation. However, I have heard that perhaps that would be addressed to be a bit more of control. This was more on the Senate side, that they would maybe look at setting that up a little bit differently than what's currently in statute. Right now, there's no money in that fund. So that, again, this is subject to appropriation and further direction from the legislature.
Okay. Representative Pruitt?
I kind of want to hit in that same vein. Can you talk to me a little bit about, obviously, there's Section 8 talks a little bit about subsidiaries. And I think kind of to the point there and the authority that AEA will have, it's possible there's a misconception that by creating a subsidiary, while we're passing off the liability from the lead agency, the AEA in this case, it's not like they're designated any additional powers. That's how I understand it. Now, can you talk to that and if that's the case and speak a little bit more on the subsidiary aspect of that this bill is requesting?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, this Brian Bjorka, Senior Assistant Attorney General. You're correct. The Alaska Energy Authority could only grant to the subsidiary the powers that the Alaska Energy Authority has. And so it could not give to the subsidiary corporation any more powers than AEA has. And so the boundaries are whatever statutory authorities the Alaska Energy Authority currently has. And so if you look at the statutes dealing with the Alaska Energy Authority, you'd be looking at the maximum authorities that could be given to the subsidiary. Now, the Alaska Energy Authority can choose to provide less than 100% of the powers that the Alaska Energy Authority has, and that might be very appropriate depending upon what the project is, et cetera. It would not make much sense probably for the Alaska Energy Authority to grant powers related to other programs that have nothing to do with the particular project, power project as an example. And so you would start off with the maximum, which is what are the powers, statutory powers, that Alaska Energy Authority has, and then probably look at contracting those powers for purposes of what powers would be given to a subsidiary.
Okay, thank you. And in that vein, if you follow up. This bill also is related to AEA, and I think there's a misunderstanding that AEA, we're specifically talking about SUSTNA, AEA specifically as it relates to SUSTNA. But AEA has currently, they already handle other funds, other energy type situations. They, of course, they've got the bonding or the bonds that they have from the former projects they had. And I think there's maybe some thought that we need to pinpoint and give AEA only the specific powers over a Lower Wautauna project. What would the negatives of doing that be, and what would the positives? I want to make it clear, if we keep the powers down, and again, you know, the irony of being in the Ramona Barnes room is always going to, shine over this. How do we make sure that we're talking about the authority AEA has? Is this just for a Lower Wautauna project, or is this fully for energy throughout Alaska?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the powers, House Bill 103 would provide AEA the ability to own and construct new projects. Of course, we have this one particular project that we're pursuing, but there could be opportunities in the future in other areas of the state that it would make sense for AEA to pursue ownership. I think it is important that we do we are provided a bit of a broader power, the pre-1993 power, in order to look at opportunities that make sense, that state ownership would make sense. And I think what we would be looking at is what type of criteria would it make sense for us to own something rather than a local utility. Like, for example, the Susitna project is pretty clear on it. Following this Bradley model, it would be serving multiple utilities, and having a central ownership process would make sense. Now, in other areas, there may be a process where, in a smaller community, that it would make some sense for us to be involved as more of a, we have some technical expertise and the ability to do some things that maybe a small community or utility wouldn't have the ability to do that, and we provide some type of more reassurance to the legislature that it would make sense for us to own it. So those are some of the things that I think, and there's a board meeting on Thursday that I plan on discussing with the new board members with respect to us receiving this power. How would we implement it, or what would be the criteria that AEA would look at in order to implement it? I would expect that we would be evaluating projects on, you know, a feasibility analysis on, is our effort going to be something that would enhance the value and protect any type of investment? And that's the important part to keep in mind, too, with the legislature, is AEA doesn't have a pot of money that it's sitting on just waiting to invest all over the state with respect to owning projects. We have, although this authority would provide us the ability to own new projects, we don't have the financing capability of just owning a bunch of new projects. So I fully expect that as we move down this process, that there may be times that maybe there would be a particular project that we would want to start a preliminary permit application again with FERC if it was that type of a project that right now we don't have the authority to do. And maybe that would then provide the additional information with respect to, you know, a schedule and costs of a project. And so it would be unfortunate if we were in a situation where we'd have that type of question come up where we'd want to exercise that authority in September, but the legislature doesn't meet again until January. So I view it as a tool that we should be looking at on using moving forward with the kind of the reestablishment of AEA's programs. And although it was severely restricted in 1993, the kind of reestablishment of AEA as a more full state corporation really started in 1999, when the former Division of Energy programs from the Department of Community and Regional Affairs were reestablished as AEA programs, or responsibilities of AEA. And so through the years, there's been this progression of having AEA become the focal agency for energy policy and programs of the state. And so this is, again, just another continuation of having AEA be an instrument of the state of Alaska to pursue the energy policy and programs.
Representative Pruitt?
As AEA currently is part of ADA, and ADA has the ability to bond on their own, how does that change? And kind of to the point, you don't have a pot of money that you can sit on and just spend. But would you have the bonding ability that, without legislative approval, you'd be able to go out and establish projects on your own?
Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, AEA and ADA are two separate and distinct corporations. They have independent existences. There are relationships between ADA and AEA, in particular the staffing issue. And although the same people that serve on the ADA board serve on the AEA board, they don't meet as like a joint board. They convene as an ADA board. They convene as an AEA board. So AEA, because of outstanding of owning projects and outstanding bonds, has always maintained its recognition as an independent corporation. AEA also has bonding authority now. That was one aspect in 1993 that wasn't restricted. We have the ability to issue bonds. So this would be the ability to provide new, again, I guess, you know, this has been somewhat of a theoretical question with respect to would AEA go out and issue bonds to own projects. you still, as you mentioned, the business plan, you need some type of plan. You need a process where what would pay the, you know, what would, if you issued bonds, if you're going to own something, what would pay the, what would pay AEA back, or what would serve the service the debt on any type of a project. So there's going to have to be some type of a business case study with respect to any project that we would pursue.
Very good questions. Are there any other questions? I think we wanted to use this time to give the opportunity to committee members to ask their questions, and I think what we'll do next is move to the public testimony. I do want to mention at one point, I think I said Alaska Power Authority. I meant Association. Larry Markley was looking at me back there. But is there anything else? Seeing none, that wraps up today's hearing. On Thursday, we're going to start public testimony about the bill and the proposed Wetana project. We also plan to continue those public hearings next Tuesday as well. Representative Pruitt and I will put out a press release about this to help make sure that the members of the public are aware of it and that they can provide their input. So we certainly appreciate that, and we'll go ahead and gavel out here at 4:09. Thank you, everybody.